at GBQ, we're always counting. Now we're making your time count with this episode of Empower Hour. Start the clock. Today I am with AJ Orr, author, veteran, and CEO of Simple Plan ID. Welcome, AJ.
Hey, I appreciate it, Doug. Thanks for having me.
So we're going to talk today a little bit about your business, the accidental entrepreneur that I think you are after reading some stories about how that started, your service, and then close out. You've written a book covering the IT topic, and we'll close out and talk about that. Let's start with Simple Plan IT. You, I in some of the materials that I've found on the internet, you are excited by how we can use technology to be the most efficient, to be the best version of ourselves. Talk a little bit about the fun part of your business. Let's start with what's fun about Simple Plan IT for you.
So for me, the fun part when it comes to Simple Plan IT is the thing that attracted me to technology, which is it's a puzzle. You know, you've been in technology. There's 50 million different ways that you can come at a problem with a solution, but there's usually one or two that, hey, this is the most optimal way of doing it. And for me, it was always the challenge of finding the best solution, finding the best way to increase optimization, to increase efficiency, so that we can increase the bottom line, do more with less. And that was always the fun part for me. You know, for me, I'm driven by solving problems. You know, give me a problem and I will chew on it for days until I can find the best solution. And that's what's fun for me.
So as I understand the story, you are kind of an accidental entrepreneur. You were called in to solve a problem and got paid for it, realized that you could do that for a living. And that was the beginning of it. Talk about that story, because I think what I heard in it was somebody who listens first, and talk about that story with the idea of what you learned through that listening process and that first dollar that you earned.
Absolutely. So, yeah, I tell people all the time, I never had the desire to be an entrepreneur or start a business. I tell people the entrepreneurship found me and fell on me. So I'm a military guy. So being in the Army, I was trained and with the Army values of leadership, which is short for loyalty, duty, respect, selfless service, honor, integrity, personal courage. And so those are the Army core values. And so I took those with me after I left military service into everything that I did. And so long story short, I was working for an IT company doing their front end account management, project management, and sales. And Columbus is while it's a big city, it really has a small town feel in the sense of the IT community. We know a lot of the players that are in the market space. And so I would come across opportunities where the solution I represented at the time wasn't the best fit for the client. And so I've always been a big believer that if I put good things out there, then good things will come back. And so I would tell people, hey, look, you know, we could do this for you, but to be honest with you, these guys over here, they really specialize in that. Talk to so-and-so over there. He'll take really good care of you. And so what happened a few times after I would do that, I said, hey, look, don't pay me anything. If you want to do anything, just give me a referral. Next time you hear somebody having technology issues, I'd love to be the first person that they call. And so what happened was I had people that would come back and say, AJ, we trust what you're saying, but we don't understand anything they're saying over there. Do you mind sitting in on this meeting to make sure that we're getting what it is that we need because you understand it? And so I did that a few times. And once again, not asking for anything. And I did it one time. And a gentleman by the name of John at the end of the meeting gives me an envelope. And he's like, your time is worth something. Take it. He wouldn't let me leave without it. So I get in the car, open up the envelope, and it was a check for $500. I was like, holy cow, I just made $500. And all I did was be a translator. And so I was like, all right, you know what? Next time that somebody asks me to sit on these meetings, I'm going to ask them if they're willing to pay for my time. And sure enough, it happened eventually. And and they're like, yeah, sure. What's your rate? And I said, how about, you know, sheepishly $100. And of course they paid it. And I was like, I didn't even think, once again, not thinking to be a business owner or starting a business or anything, that somebody had already paid me $500 and I should have started my market right there. But that's literally how I started the business, was really just trying to be an advocate for these business leaders who didn't understand how to evaluate the technology solutions that they were looking at implementing for their business. And so that's how it all started.
Well, and I like the story because it I think underlines something. A lot of times this IT stuff to non-technical people sounds like a bad Star Trek episode. And they're trying to keep up and understand and all the three-letter acronyms that are slammed around, and they don't understand it in business terms or in people terms. And so you get a lot of head nods, but you don't get conclusions or resolutions that lay into the business environment. So that doesn't surprise me. I think there's a lot of us in tech that have to constantly remind ourselves that they don't understand our Star Trek episode.
Well, and I think to that point, that's the reason why I came up with the name Simple Plan IT for the business, because my goal was to create simple plans for people's IT and their technology. You know, take this complex thing, that this inanimate complex thing that people don't understand, and how can I translate it, simplify it down, and package it in a way that is easy for them to digest, easy for them to comprehend, and it makes business sense for them. And that's really kind of where that's the bridge that I kind of filled and the gap that I covered there.
So let's talk a little bit about Simple Plan IT and what it does. And I'll kind of reflect the personal story. Used to go to family reunions all the time. My mom would say, my son Doug does IT. I don't understand what he does, but if you've got an IT problem, he can help you. And I would invariably be in a corner somewhere talking to a relative I barely knew about some problem with her printer cartridge. Not what I do. When you talk about IT and within the Simple Plan IT, what are some of the things that Simple Plan IT does for clients?
We now get into in everything. So when I started the business, it was focused on, like I said, being that virtual CIO for small businesses and being kind of the, as my sister so eloquently put it, you're a technology filter that sits beside people and helps them to understand and translate. So I was like, yeah, that's exactly what I do. So we started the business there and then slowly got into project management and helping them to manage vendor management and things of that nature. And then we made a pivot into cybersecurity. And so we built out a security operations center, US based, where we really focus on behavior-based analytics to identify and respond to security incidents, both internal and external threats. So if you've got a disgruntled employee that's secretly downloading files, we're able to see and respond to that in next to real time so that we can helpfully prevent them from having an impact on the business.
And I think that's an interesting play. 5 years ago, we were recommending to clients, they bring their own technology in to do the logging and monitoring, essentially to record what's going on so you knew what normal was, and then you could explore, understand what abnormal was, and then react to it. We were saying, bring that in and put that into your environment. Labor risk is such an interesting issue right now. It's hard to find good people, but if I find a provider like you that's got a good process and good people, I can shift that risk to the provider. And so you do something that I think it's a struggle for small and mid-sized businesses to do on their own, which is to kind of watch the network and know what's going on.
That was the gap that we saw. So whenever we talk about businesses and technology, specifically cybersecurity, there are four things that we look at, and we call them the SATs. And I haven't come across any business that isn't struggling in one of the four areas of the SATs. And the SATs break down like this. The first S is for speed and time. Right now, the average data breach goes undetected in the United States for 6 to 7 months. So, you know, that's 6 to 7 months of somebody having access to your network and system without you even knowing. A lot of damage can be done there, and it's hard to remediate all that on the back end. So close that gap, skills and time. The A stands for adapt to change. There's new viruses that are coming out. You know, I think last statistic I saw was that there's like some 60,000 new viruses or variants that are created on a daily basis. Fantastic. You know, that means that the traditional antivirus and you know, software isn't catching all of these things in real time because they're just not able to keep up with them. And so adapting to change was another struggle. Total protection. We know that criminals now are attacking more than just computers. They're targeting people through human behavior. They're targeting your IoT systems, your smart devices, your robotics, your industrial control systems, all these things that you can't protect with traditional endpoint solutions. And so the threat vector has dramatically increased. And so being able to address that. And then the last one, skills and time. You know, we all know that there's a shortage when it comes to security experts in the market space, not only just here in Ohio, but nationally and globally. And so with everything converging on the network, you know, back in the day, it used to just be computers and servers that you had to worry about. But now you've got phone systems on the network, computer or security systems on the network. And then you've got everybody doing social media. There's so much more riding on your network now that, you know, IT vendors get overwhelmed. You know, and this is not a knock against any IT person. You know, we struggled with it. And that's the reason why we strictly focused on cybersecurity. I made that conscious point because if we're doing IT support as well as cybersecurity, it's hard to stay on top of both and do both at a very high level. And I think that's what you need to do in order to protect yourselves in this new digital landscape that we're in.
Well, I like the four principles. The one that stands out to me is I think an area that's most misunderstood, and that I've got a couple years on you at least, probably more than that, but we won't do the math.
We won't date each other.
but the reality is when I started working, it was either a mainframe or servers in a room with computers connected to the network and a perimeter, a defense of the organization, if you will, pretty self-contained. Now, even pre-COVID, we have people working at Starbucks on a laptop. We have people that are doing things on an iPad or an iPhone. You mentioned Internet of Things, IoT devices. We have systems that are embedded in our doors and our cars and our trucks and our equipment, medical devices. That attack surface, as you and I would both call it, if we got into a Star Trek episode of this, is that's what the bad guy can attack. Many times the vision that we see of the entrepreneurs, they don't know they've got this, all this stuff out there. Do you find that as a fairly consistent problem with business people? They're out exposed more than they know?
100%. And I would also add to that. So one, you're right. They don't know what their attack surface really looks like, but even more important, and I think more damaging, is that they don't understand the data that they have in their possession and where it all exists. You know, people think, oh, well, I'm small, so I'm not a target. And there's truth in that. You're not a target, but you're a crime of opportunity. You know, if you talk to a police officer, most car break-ins aren't smashes. They're doors that were unlocked and they just popped the handle and it opened up and then they got in and took whatever they could. That's how most car break-ins go. And so it's the same thing whenever you look to cyber attacks. A lot of these are just open ports and things that weren't done that left a door open or left a crack in there and somebody got in and was able to exploit it.
Very true. I think that people are more crime of opportunity today because the criminal is not going out after a big pot of information. You know, the leading attack is the ransomware. And that is, I've put you in a situation where you can't work. And if you can't work, you can't serve clients, you can't send bills, you can't get money. And they don't care who they're ransoming. And that raises the bar for these crimes of opportunity.
Absolutely. Well, and I would also add to that, I believe that there's two objectives with every cyber attack. The first one is, once they get in, can I exfiltrate whatever I can that I can monetize? So whether that's your personal data, your intellectual property, your employee data, client data, whatever it is, I'm going to take as much data as I can that I can hopefully sell somewhere and monetize. But the second objective, which I think a lot of people overlook, is can I use your infrastructure to launch more attacks? Or store things. You know, once again, can I use your computing power to further advance my initiative? And that's where I think a lot of people sleep on the fact of it doesn't matter what size you are. If you've got a computer and they can use part of your computing source to do, you know, Bitcoin mining or Ethereum, any of this type of stuff. Or, you know, we've also seen where, you know, a corporate server was compromised and a criminal was storing their pornography. And so, you know, once again, if you've got a computer system, you are a target, whether or not you believe it.
Totally agree. Obviously, when we first met, it was enough to introduce the two firms. I think that you were involved in the Chamber of Commerce. You're involved in Small Business Council. Darcy Congrove, our managing partner, is the chair of the board, and she got us put together. We said, hey, wait a minute. We do some of the same things. It's one of those comfortable overlaps, which people in IT probably don't understand. We can't do it all, but we do enough of what each other does to say, hey, wait a minute. And then that actually initial meeting was we should stay in touch, really, because some of these topics are so endemic and there aren't enough people doing the work, particularly with the last, you know, the risks of the last couple of years. Hate to start it with COVID because there were bad things going on before COVID hit.
Right.
But risks that you've seen over the last couple of years, what's changed? What, in addition to that attack surface, do you see great changes in what businesses have had to deal with from an IT perspective?
The biggest thing is the attack surface changing. And I think the other thing is educating people and trying to get business leaders to not look at cybersecurity as an IT function of their business, but look at it as a digital risk management function of their business. Because when you look at it, criminals aren't after your computers. They're after your digital assets. They just happen to live and exist in a digital format. So let's create what is your risk management process for this? How are you analyzing your environment? How are you analyzing your people? Because, you know, one of the things that I tell, you know, business leaders is that every new person that you add to your environment exponentially increases your attack surface, because now you have whatever devices they're using. Most people have at least two devices. They've got a desktop, laptop, and then they've got a mobile device that they're using to do work on. So that's two devices for that one person. Then you have to worry about their login credentials and then all of the credentials that they use for any cloud services that you use. I mean, and that's just one person. So if one person can represent at least 4 points of vulnerability, if your business is growing and you add on 100 new people, well, now you just increased your attack surface by 400 and you just didn't even realize. And so those are the type of things, getting them to realize, okay, what are you going to do to account for this new shift in risk? Because now your risk profile has completely changed. What are you going to do now to manage that? And so I think when I can get them to start looking at it from a risk management standpoint versus an IT standpoint, then the conversations really start to make sense.
I love that. We're seeing a lot of, for instance, you know, the restaurants that depend on the delivery services. Those services have to operate or they can't deliver food to the door. Now, obviously, there's more dining in now than there was a year ago, but my IT risks don't necessarily include DoorDash and Grubhub, but my digital risks include, are DoorDash and Grubhub going to stay up tonight? Because tonight's whatever, Friday night, and that's my busy night. And so it is a perspective that goes outside now of just the IT assets I control. Totally 100%. Agree with that approach.
Sometimes I have good ideas.
Yeah, it's the whole meme thing is interesting because you find people in IT that we're all thinking the same things because we're experiencing some of the same things.
Right.
And yet I think the frustrating thing is a lot of times it doesn't make it back to the decision makers. There's a gap, I think, sometimes between that we see maybe a little bit differently than you do, that we see between management and IT, particularly when IT is outsourced. That, and again, kind of characterizing from a generational standpoint, you get people that are in this older generation. I'm 56, just to market, but you know, 10 years, 15 years up and down, and they still think of it as traditional IT. And so they make decisions, or the marketing department decides to bring in a freemium CRM and they don't see the exposure.
Right.
So totally agree with that approach. And I think we're just all seeing it if we're honest about it or accurate with it, maybe is a better way to say, there's a lot more exposure to just, does my computer work?
That's why I shifted the conversation to that perspective is, let's manage your digital risk. Because if you just look at cybersecurity as an IT function, all you're thinking about are your computers, your printers, your phones. Yeah, all that stuff works and we're good. We got somebody that covers that. And which is great. You need to have somebody that covers that. But at the same time, what are your vulnerability points now mm-hmm. that exist because of all of those things?
So thinking about all this, you know, what do you see is the most difficult impediment to business today with IT? We've made this shift from an IT world to a digital world. We both agree on that. But in that digital world, what do you think the greatest impediment to businesses being successful with it?
I think it's still a lack of comprehension and really understanding the true impact. I mean, think about it. The technology that we used, COVID hit, the pandemic comes, March, the world shuts down. Everybody moves to remote learning. We're doing more video stuff and everything else like that. That technology has been around forever. I mean, the IT, what we've been telling people, hey, your guys can work remotely. They don't all have to be in the office. And they're like, no. The people have to be here in order to work. Now that we were forced to it, we realized, oh yeah, the technology is stable enough. Oh yeah, they can do that. Oh yeah, there is a better way. And so I think that's really the biggest impediment with anything is just getting people to change, because we're creatures of habit. You know, once we get into this thing, we've got this groove and no, this is the way we're going to do it. And I think the minute that we can realize that, hey, technology really takes the limitations off. You know, I tell clients all the time, you know, when you're looking to reevaluate and redo your technology solution and stack, let's take the limits off. What is it in a perfect world where everything was possible? What is it that you'd like to do? How would you like to function and operate? Let's look at that and let's see how much of that is actually attainable with the technology that exists today. And so from that perspective, I think the biggest impediment is the constraints that we put on ourselves and not realizing what is actually possible through the strategic use of technology.
So I'm going to jump ahead to the book.
Okay.
Because chapter 7 stood out to me. It was the chapter on training. And I think sometimes training is, what can I do on the keyboard? Do I know which menu to pull a certain thing down? But I think training is awareness. And we both know that one of the least expensive ways to raise security posture is to train your people to, the words of one of my clients, don't do dumb stuff. It's a little more complicated than that, but don't do dumb stuff. And then the buzzword of the day is this digital transformation. And we can't transform a business if we only transform the technology. We have to comprehend, in your words, what the technology can do, and we have to change people's skills. So 100%. The thing that stood out the most in the book, and because I jumped ahead, I am going to read the title. It's The Art of War in Business Technology, Simple Tactics for Conquering IT and Cybersecurity Challenges on the Small Business Battlefield. So we're talking about the troops in the war. They need to know how to do things, know not to do dumb things, and have some level of awareness about what the technology can do. So talk a little bit about your perspective on training. You've already started without thinking about it, but chapter seven stood out. So talk to me about chapter seven.
Yeah. So chapter seven, so the book itself, just to kind of give a quick overview, I designed the book to be a tactical guide that people could actually use and go back through. And when I was writing it, I was thinking about the Army Tactical Guide, which is basically tells a commander how to maximize the efficiency of their resources when they're in times of war. And so, you know, in looking at that frame of reference, you know, that's kind of how I built the book, was, you know, look at all the things in which the businesses that I work with that they were struggling with, and providing them with a framework on how they can do these things and execute against them to maximize their efficiency. And so when we talk about increasing efficiency and optimizing the workflow of your organization, your people, having them properly trained so that they know what it is that they can do, what it is that they can't do. I mean, and it goes into your policies and procedures, making sure that you have good policies and procedures in place to help guide and steer these things, but making sure that you're teaching them continuously. How do you improve and get the maximum utilization out of your Microsoft Office programs? There are so many people that don't understand Excel is a phenomenal tool and you can do a lot of things with it, but how many people do you know that actually even know how to do formulas in them? You know, so train them so that they can be more efficient with what it is that they're doing, rather than, oh, I was just copying and pasting this. And, you know, they don't know how to sum a total or sum a column and things of that nature. So training them so that they can get maximum efficiency out of their workflow and their daily operations will only help the business as a whole. And that was kind of the thought process, not even looking specifically at cybersecurity. Once you get into cybersecurity, it's increasing that awareness, because you know just as well as I do that, you know, over 90% of all data breaches are the cause of human error. You know, and we're prone to make mistakes, but let's not, you know, let's do our best to not be self-inflicting wounds upon ourselves.
Well, I think the job of technologists in the security game is to put safeguards or controls or barriers to what might happen when mistakes are made, as opposed to just relying on people. But people have played such a large part of that. If I click the wrong link or I give information out over the phone to the wrong person, I can cause all kinds of problems. So certainly that awareness is a big deal.
And to that point, so you're right. The old thought process was, well, I will put constraints in place to make it so that they can't hurt themselves. And from an IT standpoint, that made a lot of sense, you know, 10, 15 years ago. But now people are so tech savvy in the sense that, you know, they'll just grab their phone and they'll go do something on their phone without you even knowing. I mean, that's why we have so many shadow IT networks where, you know, you don't know what all of your end users are doing. They're manipulating corporate data with an off the market app that they found. They're like, hey, this works for me. Well, now you've got data exposed someplace else that you didn't have visibility to.
You don't even know. Yeah.
Didn't know existed. And so that's why I say train your people so that they feel comfortable in the environment, have that open dialogue to say, hey, how are you trying to operate now? What do you function? What are you doing to do your daily task? How can we incorporate technology to make it better so that you don't feel that constraint? Because as soon as I put you in a box, you're going to find a way to get outside that box because nobody likes being put in one.
To that story, we found in one client that had, they were pretty sure they had most apps identified, including some of the freemium social media apps, the phone apps that were involved in the business. And we came out with about 70, 80 apps on the inventory. At the end, when we finished the project, it was over 200.
Wow.
And so that, it was a mid-market company. I find that to be fairly typical. If IT can't move fast enough, I'm savvy enough to do it on my own. If I'm savvy enough to do it on my own and I don't know what dumb stuff may be when I'm handling regulated data, for instance, I could get a lot of people into trouble. And most of those people are trying to do good.
100%. They're not malicious at all.
Yeah, they're just making a mistake.
100%. And that's where that education piece comes and getting people to understand, you know, So I mentioned policies and procedures, having the policies in place, but then give them the education awareness that says, this is the reason why we have these policies in place, because this is the exposure that doing this will cause. And if we get exposed and this happens, then this would happen to the business. And I think the more that we can educate the even the bottom line workers and get them to buy into this concept, that's how you change the culture of your organization. That's how you fortify, you know, don't just rely on the technology solutions. Yeah, my SOC, we can detect a lot of stuff and we can try to mitigate as much damage as possible. But if you really wanted to prevent things, it starts with education and educating your people and teaching them what they should and should not do.
Well, that stood out in the book as a whole. You speak to measuring risk, you speak to managing vulnerabilities, you speak to transformation in a number of different ways. But the training piece stood out to me as the most valuable and often the thing that doesn't make the final budget, because it's a soft cost and we can cut that out. Incidentally, the other one is project management. And I know that you've experienced that most likely as a project manager.
I've been cut once or twice.
Yeah. So how did you find time to write the book? And that's not a weekend in a pencil. That was some work to put that together. How did you find the time?
I'm going to tell you, and this is going to blow your mind, I wrote the book in 60 days. It took longer to go through the publishing process and the editing process and everything else like that to actually bring it to market. But the way in which I did it, and this is a tip that I'm going to start sharing with people, and I hope that your audience can take advantage of it as well. For anybody that's out there looking or interested in writing a book, here's the process that I used. I create a framework. I knew the three things that I wanted to cover, which are, you know, how do you increase your revenue? How do you increase efficiency? And how do you protect your position? Because if you think of commander in war, that's what we're trying to do. Anytime that you're in war, you're trying to advance your position and gain more ground. You got to make sure that your troops are being as efficient as possible, that they have every resource that they need. And you got to make sure that as you're gaining ground, that you're not, you know, opening up a vulnerability on the backside to where an enemy can flank you. It's the same thing in business. You know, the difference is that you're trying to get market share rather than take land in a physical sense. And so I knew those are the three areas that I typically work with businesses and help them to utilize technology to increase those three areas. There are three things that I do in each one of those three subcategories on each one of those pillars. And what I did was, once I knew what I wanted to talk about, I recorded myself talking about those topics, because I can talk about them forever, and I can talk and, you know, think and speak faster than I can think and write. So I never lost a train of thought. I just recorded myself, had it transcribed. That gave me the framework for the book. And then from there, I just went in and cleaned it up. So that's how I was able to do it in 60 days.
So you likely drove your family a little nuts, sitting at home talking to yourself. I feel for them. But anyway, we'll put a link at the end of this and on the webpage that we post this on. I know it's available on Amazon because it's now sitting on my Kindle. And I know it's available, I think, as both a soft paperback cover and a Kindle edition.
As well as in Barnes & Nobles.
Oh, very good. Very good. What motivated you to write it? It sounds like you've got a story you like to tell. You're a storyteller.
I am.
It sounds like you have a story that you want to tell about IT. Was that the motivation or was it something else?
It was something else. So 2020 comes in, everybody had high hopes, and then COVID hit, March hits, and the world shuts down. And in June, I got diagnosed with thyroid cancer. And so it kind of rocked me a little bit, took me a minute to kind of find my bearings. I was like, all right, I accept it. This is what it is. You know, let's look at our options. And the docs told me, hey, look, AJ, you know, we know you don't want to hear you had cancer, but you've got thyroid cancer and it's the best cancer that you could possibly have. I was like, time out, doc. I was like, if that's your sales pitch, never use that ever again, because that's a horrible sales pitch. But they said it's the most treatable form. And so you're good. You know, and so I thought to myself, I was like, you know, what if that's not the case? What if statistically I'm on the opposite side of this, and this is the beginning of the end for me? What is my impact and what is my legacy? And those two words are what rang out as I wrote the entire book. What is going to be my impact and what is going to be my legacy? I wanted to leave something behind that could actually help people, and at the same time, leave something behind that my kids could be proud of. And so those two words are what I focused on as I wrote the book, having an impact, leaving a legacy. And that's how the book came to be.
Very cool. Well, I encourage people to take a look at it, particularly business leaders that may not understand technology. I like the good military stories. There's some good military stories in the book. And I think that helps kind of frame some of these IT things in a different way than I've read before. So great book. I'd said earlier, we were introduced because we had some things in common. And then agreed that at some point we might revisit and help each other's clients out. And then it was about a month later, we got bit with some of the turnover bug. Had a couple people leave the team. We're looking to rebuild the bench. And it came to mind that in my prior, the company that I had before I joined GBQ, we had some military veterans work for us. And we reached back out to the chamber and we said, who can help us with it? And we got a list of names and there's AJ Orr again. And I understand that you're involved in a organization called Bunker Labs. We'll get to that in a minute. But we've discovered that the military pipeline, those people that have men and women who have honorably served, they're discharging, have great skills, and they're entering this crazy labor market. So can you speak a little bit about that from your perception as a military veteran about what a veteran brings to a business if a business hires them?
So there's a tremendous value that veterans bring. A lot of it centers around, you know, kind of the work ethic that we were given. When you bring in a military person, and I'm going to speak to the ones that I've worked with and the ones that I know and the ones that I've helped find other positions. One, they're dedicated. So you give them a shot, they're going to stick with you. They're super loyal. Two, you're going to get somebody that's hardworking and thinks outside the box. The military teaches us, and I don't care what branch you served in, failure is not an option. And so if things aren't looking or lining up exactly the way that they were planned, well, you don't just throw up your hands and walk away. So they're creative thinkers. They're going to find a way to complete the mission for you. And to me, that's the unspoken characteristic that I think is the most valuable, that I think that as a veteran myself, I did a horrible job of being able to articulate that. Because to be able to think outside the box, I mean, sure, you'll have those that have leadership skills, and that's important and that's great. But it's the critical thinkers, those who can think outside the box and say, okay, I have to find a solution because failure is not an option. When you get people like that on your team, then anything is possible at that point in time.
And I validate that, having somebody that hasn't served. I validate that with the people that worked for me and my prior company, and then GBQ acquired us. And here we are. We've actually, since talking to you, found two gentlemen. One's with us now, former senior chief in the Air Force. I'm still getting used to yes, sir, and no, sir. Everything John's done so far validates what you just said. And I think we think here at GBQ that that's a viable place. You introduced us to some other organizations and won't necessarily talk about them, but one of the things we learned is that first year when a veteran joins an organization, they're probably at risk because it's such a big change when they move from the military culture. And really, we need to say re-enter, because I know when you entered the Army at age 17, you were a civilian up till that point. But right. Talk about the re-entry process. What's difficult about that for a veteran? Because it's not a simple thing, is it?
It's not. The transition, you know, I tell people all the time that the military does a great job of transitioning you in and creating you to be a soldier and to live that soldier lifestyle. But then that transition out, that re-entry into the civilian world is tough. And really, there, when I look back on it and looked at my own life experience, you know, I went in and I served. I was in between both wars, so I never saw combat and I never got deployed overseas. But it still took me 3 to 4 years to acclimate to civilian lifestyle. And whenever I went back and after making it through and analyzed it, there were two things that really stuck out to me that I attribute to the struggle, which is the first is that I lost my sense of purpose. You know, when you're in the uniform, you're part of something bigger than yourself. You know, the mission supersedes anything. You know, no pettiness gets involved. The mission is the mission. The mission has to be completed. And so you've got a sense of purpose because you're representing something bigger than yourself. When you get out, and I was no longer AJ, part of the uniform, part of this great branch that defends democracy, I was AJ Orr. And who is AJ Orr in the civilian world? I didn't know. I didn't know how I fit in there. So that was a big struggle, just trying to find my identity and where I fit into this world that I wasn't used to. It was foreign to me. The second piece was I lost my network. You know, I was surrounded 24/7, 365 by people that thought very similar to me. It was, hey, we could hate each other, but we knew that whenever it was time to go to work, that I could trust you to do your job and protect my life, and you could trust me to do my job and protect your life. And then after the mission was done, because the mission was number one objective, the second objective was that everybody got home safely. And so when you're in that mindset, surrounded by people in that mindset, there's a closeness there. And then you get out of that and you get, you know, kind of thrown back in or reintroduced to the civilian world where you don't have that closeness, where everything is about me and everything's an individual. And so you live your life as being, I'm a team, I'm not an individual, to now I'm an individual. How do I survive? That was the biggest challenge for me. Those two things were the biggest things that I struggled with. And it seems to resonate with a lot of other veterans that I talked to upon reentry.
The research that we did says everything you just said, not nearly as passionately, because some of it was in brochures, but very much that was the case. And one of the reasons why that first year is so difficult, what we also found out was, and the passion that you just said that I think speaks to it, is that the veteran that joins you and makes that first year then becomes a part of your mission, becomes family. That's what military veterans are looking for as they enter the business world. And we're thrilled that we have the two that we've identified, and we're going to begin to more fully develop that. So it's hard for a military veteran to leave the military and join civilian life. Having been an entrepreneur for a number of years, I can't imagine how much more difficult it is to leave the military and start a business. Of course, your mission comes with that. But there's a lot of other lessons that I would imagine have to be learned. And that's what Bunker Labs helps with. Can you talk about Bunker Labs a little bit?
Absolutely. So Bunker Labs is a national nonprofit headquartered out of Chicago. We've got chapters all over the country. I happen to be part of the leadership team that is here in Columbus, as well as kind of covering the entire state of Ohio. But Bunker Labs' mission is to help veteran and veteran spouses who are interested in being entrepreneurs. As many of you guys know, being an entrepreneur can be a lonely road. And the biggest challenge, I think, with being an entrepreneur is that you don't know what you don't know. And, you know, whenever I look at, you know, I'm fortunate enough, I started the company back in 2012, and here we are now still working, growing, and thriving. But there were a lot of mistakes that were made. And they were the mistakes that were made were made because I didn't know any better. I didn't know what I didn't know. And so that's the goal of Bunker Labs, is to one, help equip them with resources, help them to understand, hey, you don't know what you don't know. Here's information that you need that will help you along the way. So, you know, as you're starting to launch your business, that you're not walking into this thing with rose-colored glasses, because, you know, in the beginning, you know, I felt victim to it. I thought, I've got the best idea. I'm going to build this thing and I'm going to light the world on fire. I'm going to be a millionaire in the next 24 months. And lo and behold, that was nowhere close to being the truth, but I didn't have anybody to say, hey, calm down. Here's how you set realistic expectations. Here's how you check your key performance indicators. This is what you need to do. And so that's what Bunker Labs is there to do. So one, to help level set expectations, give you information that you need. The second thing that they help to do is to provide you with an ecosystem. You know, it's not who you know, it's who knows you. And being able to plug into a network where, you know, I'm starting a business, great, you need a good attorney. Okay, gosh, how do I vet an attorney? Well, now you don't have to, because now we're part of a network where we can bring you in and we can show you, hey, these guys really work well. You need an accountant as you start to grow. Hey, you're looking at getting venture capital funding. This is how you present yourself. All of these different things, creating that ecosystem is really the crowning jewel that Bunker Labs brings to the organization or to any organization.
So given a veteran that's been used to a network of like-minded people, essentially another network with the kinds of information that they really need to depend on for that next step in life, whatever that entrepreneurial dream might be.
100%.
Well, very cool. We're down to the final countdown. I've got some questions to ask. 5 questions we ask every guest. So we'll run down through these here real quick. What did you dream of becoming when you were in middle school?
In middle school, I was really big into nuclear physics and astronomy. So I was really, I loved chemistry. So nuclear physics and astronomy was really what I was after.
So AJ Orr, the scientist, or the global, the universal traveler.
There we go.
Who inspires you?
I'm inspired by a lot of people. I wouldn't say individual. I get inspired by talent. Being self-aware and understanding what my gifting is, it allows me to see others' people's gifting. And so I get inspired by that. So anytime I see somebody else succeeding, that inspires me to push my levels harder and to go further. And so inspiration to me is endless, and it's abound everywhere, even in the smallest successes.
What is your favorite life hack?
Writing the book was probably the most productive life hack that I found, was recording, transcribing, and being able to do that in 60 days. That was a tremendous life hack that I think I found there. And I hope I can share that with others.
What has been your most valuable failure?
The next failure that I'm going to make. As long as I continue to fail, that means that I'm pushing to grow. And as long as I'm growing, then life is good.
That's a great answer. So all of this has been about work and service and things that relate to your professional career. One last question. You obviously work very hard. How do you play to balance life out?
Oddly enough, as much of an extrovert as I am, and I love being around people and I love being in the mix of things, I'm a homebody. I've got a wife and four kids, two boys, two girls, and nothing makes me happier than whenever I can unplug and just hang out with them and watch my kids be kids. It just kind of takes me back to, you know, just being a kid when things were so much easier and you're not I mean, as an entrepreneur and especially in the IT and cybersecurity space, you're constantly in the thick of, you know, I tell my wife, I was like, I'm really nothing more than a glorified firefighter. I'm constantly putting out fires left and right. So to be able to unplug, watch the kids and interact with them, that's the greatest joy that I have.
Awesome. What a great answer. So last question, where can our listeners connect to you online? LinkedIn, I think look for AJ Orr on LinkedIn.
Just go to ajorr.com.
ajorr.com.
Yep, ajayorr.com. And all of my contact stuff will be there and you'll be able to reach me. And if you ever want to talk, feel free to reach out, man. I'm always open to help solve a problem because for some reason, that's what excites me.
So ajorr.com, yes, he's very accessible. Also on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, I think you said.
I did.
The Art of War and Business Technology. Simple Tactics for Conquering IT and Cybersecurity Challenges on the Small Business Battlefield. AJ, thanks for joining us today.
No, thank you, Doug. Appreciate it.
Time's up. Thanks for listening to this episode of Empower Hour. Join us next time by subscribing to Empower Hour on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or your preferred listening platform. Want more GBQ? We don't blame you. Visit us online at gbq.com for the business news and advice that matters most. Who is empowering your growth?